This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
It was during a gun battle with the IRA that my eldest daughter landed her most memorable kick. My wife and I were under Waterloo Bridge at the time. Glass was flying, the air was loud with bullets, hot lead had blown out the windows, obliterated the tip of someone's cigarette, blasted the clock from the mantelpiece. Everyone was diving for cover. Everyone on the screen, that is. They were in Dublin during the Irish Rebellion. Or rather, they were on a set at Elstree Studios, on which the Dublin of 1917 had been recreated in plaster and wood for The Informer, one of the late masterpieces of British silent cinema. And in front of them, on the stage of the National Film Theatre, two men were allowing this brilliant old movie to be as brilliant as it could be. The violinist Gunter Buchwald and the pianist Neil Brand, two of the world's great silent film musicians, performers who know how to conjure a sound to fit an image captured 8 or 9 decades ago, how to improvise with the ghosts of the teens and twenties. So a line of bullet holes traversed the glass like the bites in the hungry caterpillar's leaf. A teacup exploded on a tray, a mirror cracked, a light bulb exploded, and my daughter, as yet unborn, lurched energetically in the womb in what my wife always describes as star jumps. You're never too young to feel the power of silent cinema. Silent. Now, there's a sticky term. What was silent about silent cinema? Not the giant Wurlitzers that could produce a cacophony of car horns and cowbells and timpani. Not the specially manufactured .22 caliber revolvers that fired blank through blocked barrels and made Western shootouts thrillingly authentic. Not the benshi, performers who gave live interpretation in Korean and Japanese cinemas, translating foreign intertitles, commenting on the action, ventriloquizing the figures on the screen. Not the bands and orchestras who played full scores or worked from complex cue sheets to match the mood of a scene, and did their work so powerfully that commentators in the 1920s predicted that the picture house would soon supplant the concert hall. "The future of music will be the cinema," declared the conductor Hermann Dorewski in 1920. "It will be written by the Wagners, the Strausses, the Elgars of tomorrow." But we can pull back further here to the sound world of silent film production. On a movie set today, stern people in puffer jackets call for absolute quiet. If someone's ankles crack too loudly, you hear, "Cut, we're going again." In the first two decades of the 20th century, they weren't concerned about traffic noise or the sawing and hammering of the chippies, and there was melody on the set as well as noise. Studios employed small bands to strike up mood music for the actors, to fluff them into the required emotional state. Stars had their own favourites to help them get into the zone. When you see Mary Pickford emoting on screen, you must imagine a little quartet just out of shot playing a romantic tune called "From the Land of the Sky Blue Water." John Gilbert favoured Moonlight and Roses. For the battle scenes in Intolerance, D.W. Griffith kept his extras marching to time with a brass band. Perversely, it was the talkie that plunged cinemas into something much more like silence, as the music was pared back to allow those first delicate lines of recorded dialogue to make what progress they could through cavernous auditoria. It's hard to reconstruct this moment, as in later years, every British filmmaker who'd been alive in the late 1920s pretended that they'd known it was all over for the silent pictures the moment Jolson broke into song. The evidence is there, though, in some of the pictures that survive from this borderline period, when films were being produced as part talkies or in separate talkie and talk-free versions. Take a look at a movie called A Cottage on Dartmoor, made at the very end of the 20s by Anthony Asquith, son of the Liberal Prime Minister, habitual wearer of boiler suits, director in later years of deluxe, well-upholstered vehicles for British stars. Like so many films of the late 1920s, A Cottage on Dartmoor is about a love triangle. It's set partly in an upmarket beauty salon where, without wishing to give anything away, there are a lot of razor blades knocking about. At one stage in the story, the figures at the apices of the love triangle all find themselves in the cinema. and while one burns with jealous hatred, the others watch the show. The first film on the bill is a silent comedy. We know this because the audience is laughing uproariously, and two little boys are giggling and nudging each other and pointing to a whey-faced man in spectacles who bears a passing resemblance to Harold Lloyd. Once it's over, the curtain goes up on a talkie. We know this because we see the musicians in the pit putting their instruments down and cracking open their beer. What's the picture like? Well, we're not allowed to see it, but we do get to gaze upon the faces of the audience, and this tells us all we need to know. They frown, they fidget, their eyes glaze over. An old lady gets out her ear trumpet and strains to listen. What would the original audience have heard when A Cottage on Dartmoor screened at the Premier Theatre Bristol, the Derby Cosy or the Sandgate Pavilion? Well, the musicians in those cinemas would have fallen as silent as their counterparts on the screen, and the management would have put on a disc created using the technology of the German Klangfilm group of companies. No copies of this disc seem to have survived, but the pictures imply that it was something very clever. Distorted voices, sometimes comprehensible and sometimes not, sometimes clear and sometimes muffled, subverting the talkie at the moment of its invention. A decade ago, I had the good fortune to talk to some of the last survivors of the world of British silent cinema, survivors like the actor Joan Morgan, who could recall working for the Motograph Company at the Crystal Palace in Sydenham, where, in 1913, she was tied up in a sack and thrown into a river in the cause of cinema. Cora Goffin, who remembered that in 1922 she'd shot a scene of a car accident on the streets of Paris, and that the director, too mean to hire a crowd of extras, relied on the fact that the real public and the real police would come running into his shot. Jack Cardiff, who worked as a teenage runner on the set of The Informer and had two strong memories of the film, being put in charge of fetching bottles of Vichy water for the director, who used the stuff to assuage his chronic flatulence, and being told to maintain a suicide watch on an actor who'd just been abandoned by his wife. All of them are gone now, and their world is so distant that you now need to be on the home straight to a century even to recall being in the audience. You need to be 97, like Marguerite Patton, the home economist and cookery writer, who began her long career by teaching the nation to transfigure spam into food. When I met her recently, we found ourselves talking about her childhood experience of cinema, which encompassed a trip to see the 1925 MGM version of Ben-Hur. She remembered the famous chariot race not just for its exhilarating violence, which took the life of a stuntman tossed 30 feet in the air and onto a pile of lumber, but for the way in which the musicians responded to the action on the screen. The piano, she said, seemed as if it was about to catch fire. The star, Ramon Novaro, exerted a similar effect upon the audience. A family tragedy, however, brought a sudden end to Marguerite's life as a movie-mad girl in suburban London. When she was 12, her father died, and her mother revived the teaching career she'd left behind at the altar. Money was tight, cinema was an unnecessary expense. Marguerite Brown, as she was then, mounted a charm offensive, and she and her younger brother were eventually permitted to attend a Saturday morning screening at their local cinema in High Barnet, an orientalist fairyland of plaster minarets and sphinxes. The visit, however, was a species of disaster. "I can still remember how we both were when we came out," she recalled. "Mother said, 'Did you enjoy it, darlings?' And I still know the feeling that I had, that I didn't like it a bit, but couldn't say so because it was supposed to be a treat." That evening, her brother was felled by an attack of croup. Mrs. Brown rushed around with menthol rub and steaming kettles of water. "It was the film," exclaimed Marguerite. "A terrible film, an awful film." And that was the end of going to the cinema on Saturday morning. One sequence was the principal cause of their anxiety. "There was a train going under the English Channel," she related. "It was so vivid, and whether it was enemy action or a criminal or an accident, I don't know, but I can still see as I talk to you a scene of water coming in through that railway tunnel and the people struggling like mad." As she spoke, I could see it too. I knew the film. It was Morris Elvey's 1929 science fiction epic, High Treason. Having seen the picture more recently than Marguerite, I could fill in a few details. The twinkling electronic bomb concealed by terrorists on the film's equivalent of the Eurostar. The carefree socialite stowing her lapdog in a little pouch hanging from the wall of the compartment. The cocktail party atmosphere in the final moments before the explosion. "Well, isn't it extraordinary?" she exclaimed, flabbergasted to find that a nightmare vision from her childhood had been screened in Trafalgar Square only a few months before we spoke, and that she wasn't the only person still to carry this imagery in her head. It was an unexpectedly emotional moment. Marguerite's memories are sharp and clear. Our broader culture now records only the faintest impressions of the sound world of the silent cinema. If someone we know is being self-pitying, we're apt to lift an invisible violin and go, la-dee-da-da-dee-da-dee. I think this is because a century ago, hard-pressed cinema bands would look up at the screen, see that pathos was required, and make easy recourse to Hearts and Flowers. Perhaps in the 1930s, when all the cinema orchestras were disbanded, some of their jobless alumni played it on the pavement for pennies. What began, I suspect, as a Pavlovian technique for wringing tears out of an audience, shifted to cliché, then to irony, then to a forgotten joke, an unregarded archaeological fragment. In my childhood, silent films were on television all the time. Chaplin and Lloyd entertained us before tea and during the summer holidays. Later, Channel 4 commissioned handsome restorations of Nosferatu and Sunrise and The Wedding March. That doesn't happen anymore. Television has almost completely abandoned its commitment to silent cinema. So I've had to take my children to see silence on the big screen. The effects haven't all been good. It's quite hard to explain to a 9-year-old what the It means in the title of Clara Bow's It. And thanks to their familiarity with the scene in Modern Times in which Chaplin accidentally sprinkles cocaine over his prison canteen dinner, my kids sometimes ask for nose powder on their pasta. So far, they're satisfied by Parmesan cheese. And anyway, I don't take them to the cinema to make them more virtuous. I take them because I want them to feel the power of these works. I want them to get their kicks. I want them to know that the medium that gave them Up and Despicable Me and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang has a deep, deep history which they are free to claim as their own. To know that there's something that the ghosts want to say to them, which they might want to hear. At the end of The Informer, the anti-hero of the picture, an Irish Republican played by Lars Hansen, a Swedish actor with clear, bright eyes, is gunned down on the stairs by his former comrades. The pistol shot sends a cloud of powder moving in the air. As the assassins make their getaway, Hansen staggers out through the door. Opposite is a church. To him, it looks a good place to die. It's dark inside. The only light comes from the votive candles. At the altar rail, though, is a figure at prayer. She looks up. He recognises her. It's the mother of the man upon whom he informed, a man who, because of him, has been killed, escaping from the police. It seems a sign of redemption, and he crumples to the flagstone floor, his prone body caught in the cruciform shadow of the window. On the night we saw the picture under Waterloo Bridge, something remarkable happened. The final frames of the film had streamed through the projector. The final notes of the piano and violin had melted away, and the room was filled with a deep, warm silence. Nobody moved. Nobody spoke. Not the living, nor the dead, nor those yet unborn, unnamed, unknown.